Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Well, good afternoon and welcome along to today's edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, part of Faith Explored here on Premier Christian Radio every Saturday afternoon. And this is the place where Christians and non-Christians get together for discussion. And this is the first in a series of shows that I'm labelling the Summer of Scripture on Unbelievable, as we bring different voices debating whether Scripture is reliable, some of the historical events of the Gospels and more besides. So I've got about four of these episodes in a row that we're calling the Summer of Scripture on Unbelievable today. And I'm going to be introducing my two guests who I'm really excited to have with me for today's programme in a moment's time. Don't forget that you can listen back to episodes of Unbelievable at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can also tune into the podcast there. Make sure that Unbelievable's always with you on the go. You can also find articles, videos and more resources too. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Later on today, here on Premier, between 4 and 5, the profile includes interviews with the Salvation Army Worldwide General Andre Cox and former Catholic Archbishop Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor. So do stick around if you can. For the moment, let's get into today's edition of the debate show that gets very different people talking to each other.
You're unbelievable.
Well, I'm really excited about today's programme, the first of two shows when I'm joined by Bart Ehrman and Tim McGrew to discuss the Gospels and whether they're reliable. And I'm going to be explaining the theme of this first show to you in just a moment's time. But to introduce my guest, Bart Ehrman is a New Testament scholar at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's well known for his popular books that often question the reliability of the New Testament documents, such as Misquoting Jesus. In fact, first time I had Bart on many years ago, we were debating that book. Jesus Interrupted, another book that covers different but equally sceptical ground. He's been on Unbelievable many times now over the years. It's always fun to have him in studio with me. Last year in debate with Simon Gathercole on Bart's book, How Jesus Became God. If you want more about Bart, ehrmanblog.org is his website. Tim McGrew joins me today as well, scholar of philosophy and religion at Western Michigan University, as well as his studies in epistemology. And you may recall, if you're a regular listener, that he debated the atheist Peter Boghossian on this show last year on that subject. He's actually also turned his hand to scholarly work supporting the reliability of the New Testament and the Gospels as faithful records of Jesus's life and ministry, including the claims of the miraculous. If you want to find out more about Tim, then he's got an academic page at wmich.edu. That's the website of Western Michigan University. But you can find many of his talks and writings elsewhere too, including the Apologetics 315 website. So it's a delight to have you both joining me, gentlemen. Welcome along to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much.
It's great to have you by phone, Tim, from Michigan. Bart here in studio with me today. I think we've said this before, but you've got family relations, at least here in the UK, so it gives you opportunity to swing by the studio
indeed.
So often.
Yes.
It's almost an annual occurrence now.
It's becoming that, yes. It's nice to be with you again.
No book to promote this time, though. We're just here to have a conversation, really, aren't we?
Yes, indeed.
I mean, anything you're working on, though, that we
I
can
actually
look
have
forward
a book.
To?
I actually have a book coming out that's very closely related to what we're talking about. I've just finished it, and so it's with the publisher. It'll come out probably in March of this coming year. It's I'm not sure what title we're going to call it. My working title is In Memory of Jesus, or I'm sorry, it's In Memory of the Messiah.
Okay.
And it's about what scholars tell us about memory and the reliability of memory and the problems of memory and how that affects our understanding of the memories of Jesus in early Christianity.
That sounds really interesting.
Yeah.
And we must do that.
It will be extremely interesting.
Yeah. Well, look, we're going to be talking today with Tim about issues around the reliability of the New Testament, which, of course, you've written on extensively. It's funny, though, to me, because sometimes you're regarded almost as a foe of Christians because you have a skeptical view on certain things. Sometimes as a friend, because you're no friend of the Jesus mythicists, you know, those who say that Jesus never existed. You wrote a whole book against that view. So in a sense, you straddle sort of neither camp fully in that sense. You're not an out and out skeptic in that sense.
Well, it's a little bit odd because I get attacked by both sides rather vigorously. And my personal view of it is that I'm actually not against Christianity at all. I'm against certain forms of fundamentalism. And so virtually everything I say in my books are things that Christian scholars of the New Testament readily agree with. It's just that they're not hardcore evangelicals who believe in the inerrancy of the Bible. If you believe in the inerrancy of the Bible, then I suppose I'd be the enemy. But there are a lot of Christian forms of belief that have nothing to do with inerrancy.
Right. I mean, speaking of mythicists, I understand there could be a debate with Bob Price, who's a fairly well known on the internet as a leading Jesus mythicist in the offing. But I think there's a certain amount of money has to be reached that you're suggesting be raised for charity in order to make it happen.
Yeah, that's right. I do my speaking gigs for charity, and I have a set amount of money that I ask because I'm not taking the money myself. Mm. I'm using it for charity, so I have to choose which events I'll do since
sure.
I can't do everything.
Of course.
And so there's a fundraising campaign right now, and I'm not altogether sure it's going
okay.
to happen.
Well, yeah. We'll see. In any case, great to have you back on the show.
Thanks.
And thanks for coming by. Tim, welcome along. Welcome back. Great to have you with me again. We had a really fun time last time, didn't we, with Peter Boghossian. What was some of the response you got after doing that particular show with me?
Oh, goodness. It was my 15 minutes of fame, I think. Suddenly, I was receiving emails from friends, emails from enemies. So I get hate mail too, Bart. I know what that's like. And that was fun. I don't know if Bart's aware of Peter's definition of faith, but it's pretending to know things you don't know. That's his definition. And so we had a bit of fun going after that.
We did. I think it probably was the most popular show of last year in terms of the downloads it received. So it's great to have you on a reasonably different topic this time, obviously.
Sure.
Why then, as a primarily a philosopher of religion, have you turned your hand to looking into the reliability of Scripture?
Well, I think that it's obvious that Christians should want to know whether what they believe is true. Unlike most of the world's other major religions, Christianity professes to be founded on certain facts. And those facts are facts that are supposed to be accessible in space and in time, and so they're amenable to investigation, and we can look into them. If it's false, I should think everyone would want to know that it's false. If it's true, I should think everyone would want to know that it's true. So that was sort of the genesis of it for me. As a high school and college student, I went through a period where I sincerely doubted whether it was true and wanted to know. I didn't do anything wild and exciting, but I spent a lot of Friday nights in the library up to my elbows in lexicons trying to puzzle my way through.
You rebel, you, Tim.
Like
I was going to say, you're such a rebel, you know, spending your Fridays.
Oh, yeah, terrible. I had people at the Bible college where my father taught Greek for many years say to me, you're off the beaten path. You could get really messed up.
Mm.
And when I said I was going to study philosophy, that only intensified that. And yet, here I am. The pulling and the hauling have not convinced me that Christianity is false. Rather the contrary, I think that my faith has been strengthened by the study of these things, sort of the opposite direction from the direction that Bart has traveled.
Well, we're going to talk about your different takes on the Gospels today. And the show that we start with, and I'm really pleased that you guys can stay on for another show after this as well. But we're going to start with simply the question, can we trust the Gospels? As Bart and Tim debate how much we can historically believe about those accounts of Jesus's life. How early were they written? Can they lay claim to being eyewitness accounts? What were the theological intentions of the authors? What about the miracle claims? Does historical research require that we dismiss such accounts as myths? And how reliable a historical portrait of Jesus do we get through it all? Lots to cover there, and I'm not saying we will cover it all, gentlemen, but I'm just very happy to see where it goes. We like to keep things conversational here on Unbelievable. It's not a strict debate in that sense. And I just think it's fun to get you two together, because where else can that happen but on Unbelievable? So we're gonna get into the subject in just a moment's time. A quick reminder, if you're listening and you'd like to contribute your thoughts on today's discussion, you can email them to me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also find us on Facebook, on Twitter, at UnbelievableJB, the Twitter handle, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB, for the Facebook page, to leave your thoughts there as well. And of course, the show page is available online, where you can listen back to the show, leave your comments there, forward it on to a friend, subscribe to the podcast, and everything else. PremierChristianRadio.com/Unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, let's get into some of the meat then of what we're going to be discussing on the programme today. Perhaps, Tim, we could begin with you, and because that might be the best place to start, and then you can sort of lay out what you think are Bart's primary critiques and the things that you'd like to respond to in the course of today's programme. You've obviously read Bart's books. What then do you think are the key objections that Bart raises to the historicity of the Gospels?
Well, I think he does a kind of a full-court press. Bart wants to maintain the position that nobody knows who wrote the Gospels, that we are not in a position to say that any of them were written early, that is, within, say, 30 years of the crucifixion, that the historical testimony to their authorship is unreliable for various reasons, that they're full of contradictions, contradicting one another and occasionally contradicting themselves, one gospel contradicting itself in two passages, that they make historical blunders, and that not only is this true, but they are full of these kinds of errors from one end to the other, so that when you really get down to nitty-gritty and you start investigating, reading them horizontally rather than just reading each one as a self-contained story, the difficulties mount up to the point where it's hard to take them as reliable documents in the sense in which we might say Josephus Antiquities is reliable when he deals with matters that are reasonably close to his own time and isn't wholly dependent upon ancient sources which he couldn't check up on. My view to the contrary is that the vast majority of these objections that Bart raises are fairly easily resolved, that they're the kind of things we run into in secular history all the time, both ancient and modern, that the historical discrepancies sometimes turn out to be surprisingly historical confirmations, that the contradictions turn out to be, in many cases, reconcilable variations. And so, speaking purely historically now, not trying to do any theology with this, just from a historical point of view, I think these are quite trustworthy, and when they make claims, that is a prima facie reason to take those claims seriously.
So in that sense,
that they're true.
You're not here to defend a, if you like, theological doctrine of the inerrancy of Scripture, but you are here to defend the claim that they are well-attested, historically reliable documents on which we can justifiably base a faith in Jesus Christ as and the things he said and did.
That's right. I think discussions of inspiration and inerrancy are really theological and require a different approach. That's a different conversation today. I'm approaching these things just from a historical point of view and trying to see what can be said from that standpoint.
What's your take on all this then, Bart?
I mean, for that opening statement, which I appreciate very much, I have a quick question, but then I do want to make a comment. My question is, Tim, whether you do hold to the theological view of inerrancy.
Bart, you know as well as I do that that's defined in many, many different ways. I am not a, you know, one of, I don't teach at an evangelical school. I do not attend an evangelical church. Most of my publishing is not done in evangelical journals. So it's a kind of a non-issue for me. I think there are puzzles and discrepancies that I do not know how to resolve. And so I'm certainly not here to say, you know, I'm the Bible answer man, bring every question and I can answer it. On the other hand, once you've seen a lot of things that are touted as just decisive contradictions resolved, one does begin to have a suspicion that maybe something is going on here. However, from a historical point of view, I would say I couldn't maintain that. History is not even the competent instrument to maintain it. So what I'm really interested in is the historical question.
Yeah, no, I understand. I understand that. And the reason I'm asking, I want to pursue it a little bit more, even though I didn't think it was going to, I thought it was going to be an easy question because I really just wanted a yes or no. You're a philosopher, so you know. I mean, our presuppositions are very important mm-hmm. for how we engage in any kind of scholarship, including historical scholarship. My personal view is that I would have no fewer problems with my belief in Christian doctrine if I thought the Bible was inerrant than I have if it's errant. If inerrant in the sense of, say, for example, contradictions or historical discrepancies. If there were no historical discrepancies, if there were no contradictions, that would not affect whether or not I would be a Christian or not. So for me, it ultimately doesn't matter which way that the question about the Bible goes. So, but my question for you is whether you think there are any errors in the Bible.
I do not have a position on this to sell you. I'm not sure what it is about what I'm saying that isn't coming across clearly.
What's not coming across is whether
I don't know. I haven't found anything that I am persuaded must be, but I have found things which I do not know how to answer. And from a historical standpoint, I would say if they're there, then take them as a historian would take them, right? It's a wonderful line from Joseph Butler's Analogy of Religion. Let reason be kept to. And if any part of the scripture story of the redemption of man through Jesus Christ can be truly shown to be contrary to it, contrary to reason, then in the name of God, let the scripture be given up.
I just have trouble believing you don't have. I'm having trouble believing you don't have a view about inerrancy.
My view of inerrancy is that I'm weary of it.
I mean, what's the motivation behind this, Bart? Is it that you think that if someone does hold theologically, say, to a view of inerrancy, then that must impact the way they therefore do their historical research?
My view is that a person's assumptions about the Bible are going to affect how they approach the Bible. And so when I approach Josephus, I don't have a theological belief that Josephus is inerrant. And as a result of that, I can look to see whether there are errors or not. If I
sure.
really, at the end of the day, if because of my religious belief, because of what I do on Sunday morning, or because of what I teach my children, or because of what I really think late at night, if I really thought Josephus was inerrant, no matter how much I wanted to be historical, that would guide my historical research. And so I'm simply asking what Tim's views are, and I'm finding a little bit frustrating.
I do not approach this with any assumption of inerrancy. If I arrive at that,
no, I know you're. I know what you're saying, Tim. I know you're saying you don't
approach.
Yes, I understand that you're saying you don't approach it that way. But I'm asking whether you have that view or not.
I don't have a view on this that in any sense is relevant
okay,
to
okay.
my historical
you seem
to be really excited about discussing inerrancy. That isn't the topic that we're here for this morning.
Well, I know, but what I'm doubting is whether you – I mean, it sounds like you're saying that you can approach this without your own assumptions and presuppositions, and I'm calling that into question. But let's move on
because we aren't debating inerrancy.
Yeah.
But regarding the general layout that Tim made of your view of the gospel.
Gospels.
Yeah, let me just say this about that. I think, Tim, your summary of my view is right on. It's exactly pretty much what I think. The only thing I want to stress is that this that I don't want to make this out to be some kind of strange view that I have. The view you laid out about my view of the Gospels, which is an absolutely accurate view, is the traditional standard view among historical scholars of the New Testament. This is the point of view that you will find taught in every major college and university in North America, I assume mainly in England as well. It's the result of scholarship that's been going on since the 18th century. And so it isn't that I've come up with these views as somebody who kind of has a reason to attack the Bible. My popular books on this are simply expressing the views that are commonly found among historical scholars in the field.
Well, given all that, where do we begin then in terms of some of the claims that Bart makes in his books, Tim, that you'd like to take issue with? Particularly, I suppose there are these questions around whether the writings are, if you like, close enough to the events to be able to be reliable, whether that we can trust something which was written down some way after and had perhaps gone through a number of different filters before the person writing it down, as it were, put it in place. What's your approach to that kind of area as we open this up?
Right. Well, first, I'd like to point out something about what Bart just said. He says that this is a mainstream position that he takes and that it's taught in every major university in America. That's true. But Bart has also said in one of his recent books that this isn't a matter of arcane data. The data are available to him, to me, to the Sunday school teacher. And so we don't need to argue from authority here. We can look directly at the evidence. And so, you know, appeals to authority would be very interesting if we couldn't get at the data or if it required such specialized knowledge that we'd have to have quantum physics backgrounds to be able to understand even the terminology in which it's expressed. But
I completely agree with that, Tim. I completely agree. And I'm not saying that it's right because other people hold it. I'm saying that this is not a debate about whether I've got an idiosyncratic view or not.
No, I mean, if we were talking about the Western non-interpolations or about the interpretation of the Son of Man phrase, then I might say you have colleagues who are at variance with you. But on these issues, for the most part, in schools that are secular institutions, this is the position that's taken. Now, there are thousands of scholars who would take a different view, but Bart likes to bracket them by saying they're not critical historians. And so far as I can tell, the reasons for cutting them out of the fraternity of critical historians are less than compelling. But we can get into that, and I'm sure Bart will have a lot to say about that.
Well, let's just go then for your sort of basic take then on why you do believe the Gospels aren't so late in the way they were recorded and so on that they must inevitably be unreliable. What's your position on this in particular, Tim?
Sure. Okay. Well, a couple of things. First of all, lateness does not necessarily mean that a document is unreliable. There are documents that are written 100 years after the fact, which actually contain some true things that we can verify when documents written earlier do not. So you might look at, say, the account in Dio Cassius of the destruction of Herculaneum in Pompeii, festooned about with some picturesque details, but he's the first historian who talks about the destruction of those towns by the eruption of Vesuvius in the year 79, even though the eruption itself is chronicled by somebody whose uncle died in it. So lateness is not necessarily by itself a guarantee of inaccuracy. Still, I'm very impressed by both the external and the internal evidence for the traditional descriptions of the authorship of the Gospels. I know they've been heavily assailed, particularly on internal grounds, but I think that the first thing that we do in any historical inquiry, right, as a historian of science, if I'm looking at a text purporting to be by Hippocrates or Galen, I'm going to look at the external attestation first. We have to make allowances for how much we've lost in terms of the information in the immediate following era. But that allowance being made, I think the attestation is strong, it's unanimous, and I think we should have very strong internal reasons for
disregarding
it. And
this is the attestation that these were written by the followers of Jesus Christ, people who knew him.
Right, so by, say, Tertullian, Clement, Irenaeus, the Muratorian Fragment, Justin Martyr, Papias, all of these people contribute to our understanding of who wrote the Gospels in ways that I think make it a very powerful prima facie case. You'd need a lot of other evidence to undermine that.
Yes, I'd like to respond to that. I actually have a chapter on this in my new book that's coming out next year, because it's something that's interested me for a long time, namely the question of when it is you start getting the tradition that these books were written by followers of Jesus,
specifically Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they're attributed
right.
to.
The striking thing about it is that, of course, none of the Gospels themselves claims to be written by any of those people, Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. They're all anonymous. The authors never mention what their names are. And another interesting thing is that when they get quoted early on, they're never named. For example, in none of the apostolic fathers, First Clement, Ignatius, the Didache, Polycarp, etc., are these books ever named by apostolic names or even said to be writings by apostles? You mentioned Justin Martyr, but the striking thing of Justin Martyr, of course, is that he quotes Matthew, Mark, and Luke extensively, but never says that they're written by Matthew, Mark, or Luke, and never mentions John either. The only gospel he names by name is the Gospel of Peter. The first time that you have anybody of record talking about Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, our books that we are sure are Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, is Irenaeus. Now, Irenaeus is writing around the year 185. So even by standard traditional critical datings of the Gospels, this is about 100 years after the Gospels were in circulation. At about the same time, this fragment you mentioned, the Muratorian fragment, I think it's also around the year 180, 185. I think it, like Irenaeus, is closely connected with Rome. And it also mentions by name Luke and John, and it appears to know Matthew and Mark. So what this means is we don't have early extensive references to these books being written by apostles. The first time anybody mentions it is 100 years afterwards.
Okay, so a strong comeback there.
Can I respond to that?
Well, absolutely, but we're going to go to a quick break, and then we'll give you time. I don't want to cut you off in mid-flow, Tim. So we'll get your response, Tim, to that as we start to open up this question of the authorship of the Gospels. Were they attributed too late to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John to really give the impression that they were the direct followers of Jesus who wrote these records down? But we're going to get to all that in a moment's time. Fascinating discussion for you today. First of two, actually, between Bart Ehrman and Tim McGrew, my guest on Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon. You can follow us online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable and come back in a moment's time as we continue to get into today's subject.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories.
Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
This month, the Vicar of Holy Trinity Brompton, Nicky Gumbel, gives an exclusive interview on the church's ambitious planting strategy as HDB seeks to breathe new life into dying congregations around the UK. We ask, what can Christians do to defy ISIS? And meet a Mormon. Michael Flournoy explains his beliefs, while Lynn Wilder tells her story of leaving the Mormon Church for Christianity.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the programme. Today on Unbelievable, Bart Ehrman, a noted New Testament scholar who's joined me a number of times over the years and generally known for his sceptical approach in his popular books about the reliability of the New Testament, such as Misquoting Jesus and Jesus Interrupted. Well, he's here today debating with Tim McGrew, who's a Christian scholar at Western Michigan University, on whether we can trust the Gospels. I'll make sure to give you ways to see more about both their work towards the end of today's programme. But today we're really opening up some of the general issues surrounding the reliability of the Gospels. It's the programme that aims to get you thinking every Saturday afternoon as part of Faith Explored. Unbelievable. Just a reminder, you can email in if you'd like to about anything you hear on today's show, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or leave me a thought underneath this edition of the programme at the website. That's premierchristianradio.com slash Unbelievable. And you can find out the ways to become a regular listener of Unbelievable via iPod or the RSS feed or anything like that. So, Tim, just in that last section, Bart was laying out why he believes the first mention we get of this attribution of Matthew, Mark, Luke and John and so on seems so late with Irenaeus and so on, that it doesn't seem far-fetched to say that these things weren't firmly in place early on. What's your response to that?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, Bart wants to take a stand on the first mention being Irenaeus, but actually, for two of the names there, we have the authority of Fabius, as recorded in Eusebius. Mark, having been the interpreter of Peter, wrote down what Peter had preached accurately, though not necessarily in order. Matthew wrote the Logia. We can dispute over what that name means, but that he wrote it in an Aramaic tongue. People interpreted it as best they could. I think it's very important to remember a couple of things about that point. Irenaeus is the first one to mention all four authors in what we have by name, but lots of the literature of the second century has been lost. I think it's Martin Hengel who says that just looking at catalogs of works said to exist and looking at what we have in hand, we've lost at least 85% of what was there. So what Bart should really be saying is, Irenaeus is the first author to list all four of these names for the Gospels in what we now possess. That does not mean he was the first person to know it. It doesn't mean he was the first person to say it. It doesn't even mean he was the first person to write it down. And as I said, Papias does refer to some of these others. Now, there are some questions surrounding that, but that'll take us back to 125 or so, so a couple generations earlier than what Bart said. Bart brought up two other arguments. One was that the Gospels are anonymous. I will accept that if by that you mean in the text itself, they do not claim to be by certain people. So what? That doesn't mean they were anonymous in the sense that they were circulated without names on them. Martin Hengel says that as far as he's concerned, the Gospels never circulated without the names of the authors attached. So I think that that's a bit of a red herring. We can go further into detail on that if Bart would like. As far as quotations without naming, that was the other point that
then we'll
he brought
get Bart
up. Can
to come
I
back.
Just address
sure.
this? I mean, he got a lot out, and I kind of need to respond to it. Okay, Clement of Rome quotes the Old Testament all the time without naming the authors of the books from which he is quoting. I could give numerous examples. If you want, I'll cut loose with a couple dozen of them. Polycarp, in his letter to the Philippians, quotes the epistles of Paul over and over without saying, this is by Paul. Polycarp 2:1 quotes Philippians 2:10. Polycarp 11:2 quotes 1 Corinthians 5:11. Polycarp 5:3 quotes 1 Corinthians 6:9. Polycarp 12:2 quotes Galatians 1:1. Over and over and over, these guys make notice of things that they're quoting. Ignatius of Antioch does the same thing in his letter to the Philadelphians, to the Ephesians, to the Magnesians, to the Romans, his letter to Polycarp, always quoting things, very rarely stopping to say, this is the person from whom I am quoting.
Right.
It's almost as though they expected their audience to recognize these things already.
Okay. And so this, in a sense, gives us evidence that it wasn't necessarily, you know, that common to constantly be attributing things to people, even though it could nevertheless be generally known that that was the person who wrote it. I mean, I'd like to return after Bart's come back on this to this interesting issue of whether Papias sees Mark as the biographer of Peter in his gospel, because that's a really interesting sort of point of view, I think. But Bart, okay, come back on some of this stuff.
Yeah, thanks. No, it's a very interesting response. I think we're a little bit arguing past each other, and so let me be clear what I was trying to say. You, Tim, started out by saying that there is extensive external evidence for the ascriptions to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. My response was, no, there's not. And in my response, I said that the first time it's explicitly mentioned is Irenaeus. You replied by saying, well, there might have been earlier people who said this, that we've lost all of their writings because we've lost 85% of the writings. That's true. We might have. But you're the one who's claiming that there's early extensive evidence. I'm simply saying that there's not. When you indicate that that Irenaeus, that before Irenaeus, people quoted books without naming them, and you listed a number of things that are quoted in, for example, in First Clement. That's exactly right. These authors quote books without naming them. That's my point. There's not external evidence that these books were named Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You also said that technically speaking, they're anonymous because the authors don't name themselves. That's not a technicality. That's what anonymous writings are. Anonymous writings are books where the authors do not tell us their names. I should also point out that you earlier indicated that you didn't want to argue on the basis of authority, but somehow Martin Hengel got dragged in as showing us that that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were always called Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. I don't know what Martin Hengel has to do with it. He's got the same evidence you've got, which is there's nothing until Irenaeus in the Muratorian fragment. And so we probably should talk about Papias because I think it's the only thing you've got. And it's Papias is the only piece of it, and of course, Papias is highly fragmentary, and we can talk about what he's talking about. But if Papias does give us evidence that Matthew and Mark were named Matthew and Mark, that would be early evidence. That's absolutely right. Otherwise, there's nothing till Irenaeus.
Yeah, okay. Bart is going to camp on the definition of formal anonymity. I would just like to point out that by that definition, we can have absolutely secure knowledge of the authorship of anonymous documents. Their anonymity makes absolutely no difference to our knowledge of the authorship. He needs to go further than that.
No, that's right. I agree with that. I'm responding
to
your
argument.
And so
all I'm using this to point out is that that is not by itself any reason for doubting
I completely
traditional
agree.
Authorship. So
I completely
to say they're
agree.
Anonymous documents doesn't mean we don't know who the authors are.
Tim, I'm responding
naming,
to your
Bart
argument.
I misunderstood my point. Hold it. I'll give you a chance to respond. But you said something here. I want to come back to it. You said quotations without naming supports your case. What I am trying to point out is that the fact that they were quoted without being named does not provide you the kind of evidence you seem to think it does, that nobody knew who wrote them, because things everybody knew who wrote them or had an opinion, a widespread opinion about who wrote them. The letters of Paul get quoted without the author being named, and so that is not a piece of evidence for the position you're trying to defend
Well, you seem to be saying, Bart, well, I'm not trying to hold this up as a piece of evidence.
I'm not holding it up as a piece of evidence. Tim, you said that there's extensive external evidence.
Right.
And I'm saying...
Let's calibrate.
I'm saying...
Let me finish
sure. Now.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
I'm saying there's not extensive external evidence. If somebody quotes a book and doesn't tell you who the author is, that is not evidence that who you say the author is who the author was. It's not evidence. I'm simply showing that we don't have the evidence that you're claiming we have.
I guess, though, on Tim's side, he's saying, but it's also not evidence that they didn't know who.
I'm not saying it is. I'm
sure.
saying we don't have the evidence.
Okay. Where does this leave us, Tim? Okay. Does it leave us agnostic as to whether these books were or weren't attributed to their author?
Right, so let's calibrate on what counts as extensive evidence, because Bart is making much of this. How long is it, Bart, before we find in the remains of antiquity a reference to Thucydides as the author of his history?
My view is that for most authors, we don't know who the authors were.
Okay, you realize that that does put you at variance with the vast majority of ancient historians.
Yes, but you've just said we're not going to appeal to authority.
Right. So no, the point that I'm making here is not that they must be right and you must be wrong. The point that I'm making is you are now applying a standard that is not the standard of normal historical
inquiry.
I completely disagree with that standard that you're applying, maybe you have a good reason for it, but why are you applying to the Gospels a standard that historians do not apply to Thucydides?
I'm not sure how well read you are in ancient history. The reality is that the authorship of virtually every ancient source is questioned by scholars in those fields. I've written a very large book called Forgery and Counterforgery, which deals with the issue of authorship of ancient books. And if you go into the study of virtually any ancient author, there will be debates about whether the person to whom the book is attributed actually wrote the book.
The fact that there are such debates does not mean that there is a good ground for such debates. Here is a place where I really do think you just need to own that you are standing pretty far out of the mainstream. That doesn't mean you're wrong, but my take on this is we don't want to use double standards, right? You said let's not approach this with preconceptions that would make it impossible for us to reach certain conclusions. I agree, and I like the methods that historians use to study authorship and provenance and documentation on these kinds of things, and I think maybe you're going to the well a bit too often on skeptical views. I hate to say this, Bart, but that way lies mythicism.
Well, look, first of all, I don't think that if you imagine that that's where I'm going, that necessarily makes my argument wrong. I'm simply pointing out to you something that you said. You said that I'm going against what all historians say when it comes to the authorship of Thucydides. And I'm telling
not all historians, but the majority.
Yeah, so I'm not. I'm simply doing what historians do. There are debates about virtually every. There are debates about the authorship of some of Plato's dialogues.
Sure, there are.
And it's not that there are crazy, wide-eyed liberals who are debating this. This is simply a matter of historical scholarship. I'm applying precisely the same kinds of criteria that are used by historians for every ancient book, and you're not. You're simply assuming that the Christian tradition is correct, that it's Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and I'm saying there's not external extensive evidence for that.
Okay, so my use of the term extensive is calibrated by what historians actually do and actually have with respect to Herodotus, Thucydides, Xenophon. These are works where we look for testimony in the succeeding ages, and if we don't find them, we may have to go down 250 years to Polybius, and that's okay.
That's right.
But you say you're applying the standards that historians use. You're applying the standards that some historians use, but not the standards that the majority of historians
use.
Okay,
so what I would say...
In this respect, you are not doing what most historians do with ancient history.
Well, okay, I don't know we're going to have a show of hands among historians to do one thing or the other. What I would say is that this is standard critical procedure. But the other thing I'll point out is this. The people who assigned certain books to Thucydides or to Herodotus had no ideological reasons to do that. The people who assigned the Gospel of John to John the son of Zebedee, the disciple of Jesus, had very clear theological reasons for wanting to say that. And so there is a very strong difference between what we're talking about when we're talking about the Gospels and what we're talking about when referring to the writings of ancient Greek and Roman histories.
Quick response, Tim, and I would like us to move beyond the question of the authorship to some of the other issues that we started out
sure.
with.
Sure, yeah. I guess I have a sort of a Calvin and Hobbes reaction when Bart starts talking about people's theological reasons. My tail gets all bushy.
Talking about the cartoon Calvin here, yes.
Yeah, the cartoon Calvin and Hobbes. You know, we're talking about people here who were two links away, right? Irenaeus, disciple of someone who was a hearer of John. To say, well, they had theological reasons for ascribing it to John, I'm sorry, that the testimony that we have is unanimous. There's quite a bit of it. It is nearer in time than for many works of antiquity. That counts as extensive by the standards of ancient history. Bart wants to say, okay, I'm skeptical about most works. Well, you can be skeptical about most works of secular history, but at that point, I don't think that it's a fair tag to say that I'm the one who's playing fast and loose with the standards of history. Here, I'm squarely in the mainstream in terms of criteria and method, and Bart is out of the mainstream.
Well, you might think you are, but in point of fact, you're not with regard to critical history generally, and certainly not, as you yourself admitted, with respect to the Gospels, because the view you're laying out is very much a minority view. In fact, among critical scholars, you rarely find it. You find it among people who have reasons for wanting it to be Matthew,
well,
Mark,
right. Well, critical scholars being people who agree with you, and non-critical scholars being people
well,
who
look,
don't.
No, this is the view that that I learned in seminary. This isn't just a bunch of crazy, radical skeptics we're talking about. We're talking about people who have devoted their lives to studying these issues.
We're gonna have to move on from this. I understand that you're obviously diverge on this issue. I was not expecting you to come into agreement, but there's a whole area that we haven't uncovered there about, you know, these fragmentary writings of Papias and whether we can see Mark as the author writing down the history that Peter related to him and so on. But let's move beyond that to perhaps something else that's important in some of the criticisms Bart has of the reliability of scripture, and that is that as you described it, Tim, contradictions from one end to the other, and that this should give us pause for concern as to whether we can really trust these accounts if they appear to have so many points of contradiction. So talk us through a little bit of that, Tim, and maybe we should, talk about one or two of these, because I know that in Jesus Interrupted you do talk about a few. For instance, I could mention the Gospel of John puts the story of the cleansing of the temple early on in Jesus's ministry compared to the synoptics, Matthew, Mark and Luke, where it happens during the passion narrative. And so that seems like an obvious contradiction. How do you square those two together? Does it cast into doubt the story ever happened? All that kind of thing. What's your response to that particular issue, just as a starting point, Tim?
Sure. Well, the first thing to say is that if either John or the synoptic authors misplaced that or placed it someplace that it didn't happen, that does not mean that they are, in the ordinary historical sense, historically untrustworthy. It just means that we have reasons for thinking that either the synoptic authors or John got it wrong. Mm-hmm. That's a historically straightforward possibility, right? Working as a historian, you see something like that documents, you say, okay, could be. It's possible that it's the kind of thing that Jesus did twice. That would explain why he has to go up in secret to subsequent visits to Jerusalem rather than just strolling in openly. He's already made some enemies. There are some people who hold that there are theological reasons for placing it in a different spot in the chronology. That is a kind of thing that we find to some extent done, say, in Plutarch, right? He'll reorganize things conceptually rather than chronologically. We certainly find conceptual reorganization like that in the Gospels. Matthew puts a bunch of apocalyptic teaching in one place, a bunch of parables in another, a bunch of moral teachings in a third. So this kind of reorganization along conceptual rather than chronological lines is a possibility. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of ways of approaching that that don't mean saying, hey, you know what, this is just an out-and-out contradiction. Maybe it is, and if it is, there are ways of approaching that and saying, sure, okay, roll with it. Well, if it were,
what's
so
your
what?
Take on it, Tim? Do you think that John was reordering the material for his own purposes, and would that have been an unusual practice in the kind of literature?
This is a tough one. Some reorganization is done. That one, I would say, I'm inclined to think he's not, because it's woven pretty tightly into the narrative matrix in John, and it's woven pretty tightly into the narrative matrix in the synoptics. So I am inclined to think that John is not just reappropriating it and putting it somewhere else, but I know good people who do take that view. My own view, although I don't generally do this, is that probably if I had to pick one, I'd say the event happened twice. That does dovetail with some other details in John, but I wouldn't camp on that. I wouldn't say okay, I have to be right on
sure,
that.
Sure. Any
Yeah, well, I mean, my view of that is that I think it's possible to reconcile just about everything if you work hard at it. When I was a conservative evangelical Christian, I was as good as anybody at that. I could reconcile everything and did. When I was in conservative circles, when I was studying at the Moody Bible Institute, I bought a book that was called The Life of Christ in Stereo. And so this was a book that took all the details of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and kind of combined them into one big thing. So it should have been more like surround sound, because you don't have just two, you've got four things. And so you end up with this big story. And one of the ways that works is that, so Jesus cleanses the temple twice, once at the beginning of his ministry, once at the end of his ministry. And what do you do about the fact that in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus tells Peter at the Last Supper that before the cock crows twice, you will deny me three times. But in Matthew, he says, before the cock crows, you'll deny me three times. So how do you reconcile that? Well, in this life of Christ in stereo, it is reconciled because Peter denied Jesus six times, three times before the cock crowed and three times before it crowed twice. And
you find these just a bit strained, a bit kind of like it's kind of.
I think that's a bit strained. In other words, none of the text is right in what they say about him denying him three times. They're all.
Yeah.
So I think I think you can do that if that's really what you want to do.
But we've
think
already kind
also,
of said at the outset, if we're not, as it were, if inerrancy isn't in our sights.
I have no problem.
Then it might not be kind of such a. It doesn't
that's
sound
right.
to me like a massive problem that one
but
said
it is right.
the cock crows twice, the other says the cock before the cock crows.
No, that's not a big deal. It's a little picayune, little detail. And did Jesus cleanse the temple twice? No, I don't think he cleansed it twice. If he had cleansed it the first time, he would have been arrested and executed on the spot. So no, he didn't cleanse at the beginning of his ministry and the end of his ministry, in my opinion. If you want to think, though, that what simply happens is that John has sort of rearranged the dating, that's fine. Then you would say yes, John got that.
So is it your opinion that never happened at all, then, that Jesus cleansing the temple?
I think Jesus probably did go into the temple and cause a disturbance. I don't think that the way it's described can possibly be – I don't think the details can be historically right. According to our earliest account, Mark, Jesus actually shut down the entire temple cult. Mark says he didn't allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. And I think if that were actually true, you have to remember that the temple's this huge facility. You could fit 25 American football fields within the precincts of the temple. This is a huge place. If Jesus shut down the entire Jewish cult in the temple, then he would have absolutely been arrested on the spot. And so I don't think the details can be right, but I think that basically he went in and he caused a disturbance.
Okay.
He's probably right.
What's your response to some of this, Tim?
Well, two things. First of all, Jesus was very popular with the crowds, and I think that we're underestimating the extent to which the presence of a large, maybe somewhat rowdy crowd who's on your side can have a deterrent effect on a group of soldiers being sent in to arrest a man. That's not as easy a thing to just write off as Bart seems to think it is. The temple's a very big place, but access to the temple is restricted. There are choke points, and you've got to come through the gate. And this is necessary because they had to maintain the purity of the temple. There's one case where, despite their best efforts, some Samaritans came in at Passover. Josephus tells this story. And as soon as the gates opened, they came in and they started distributing bones throughout the temple, close the whole place down. Why? Well, now it's ritually impure, and the whole place has got to be purified all over again. So charming folks. They really loved the Jews, didn't they, the Samaritans? But, I just don't see the implausibility in it that Bart sees.
What of the general point, though, that Bart is making here, that, when he kind of got that book that sort of harmonized all the discrepancies.
Right, so there are wild-eyed attempts at harmonization, and then there are more sensible ones. Bart's talking about a book which is not, it has no claim to being a scholarly work. Let's take the work of somebody who is a much better scholar, say B.B. Warfield or George Park Fisher, and look at the way they handle the texts. And I think you'll see they're not trying to say that Peter denied Jesus six or nine or ten times. They look at this and they say, look, the normal kinds of variations in the way that the same story is told by somebody who's truthfully reporting it allow for variations in wording, leaving things out, contextualizing. The handling of kreia in ancient sources is something we have handbooks of rhetoric about. I don't see anything here that is outside the scope of the ordinary handling of these things. And we do need to understand that although the Bible is a very interesting thing from which we can learn a lot, it was not written to us. So we do need to understand it in terms of the standards of the time. It's by those standards that I think it ought to be judged. And this may be part of what we're coming back to with respect to the whole inerrancy thing that Bart seems fixated on. you got to understand these as documents of their times. And if you do, then I think there's not a problem here.
Judging them by the standards of their time, what other people writing the same kind of literary genre were doing, then it's perfectly plausible to see that they're reliable, they're giving us factual accounts of what happened, even if...
Sure, take the small variations in the healing of Jairus' daughter. Right, my daughter is dead, even now she is dead, she's at the point of death. But, these are all expressions the man might have used, and if he used any of them, someone retelling the story might have modified it in a way that he wouldn't have seen as being faithless to the story. We need to get past the straw man of tape recorder accuracy in the recounting of the words that are used.
I'll let Bart come back now, but your view is that if Bart has demolished anything, he's cast out upon inerrancy. He hasn't cast out upon the reliability generally of these stories.
Not even that. I think what he's casting down on is kind of a straw man of the kind of thing that they're doing. There's a certain dictation theory of inspiration according to which every single word is literally, God recorded it and is downloading the feed to you now. In the writing of this evangelist or that. I don't know any evangelicals whom Bart would disbar from the fraternity of critical historians. I don't know any evangelicals who hold the mechanical dictation theory.
Okay, we're going to take another break because I don't want to cut Bart off either by letting him respond just now. So we'll come back for a final sort of summing up of this episode of the programme. We're going to actually have a chance for a round two, though, because Bart and Tim staying on in order to record a second edition in which we'll be opening up some other areas of interest as well. You're listening to Unbelievable, the show that aims to get you thinking whether you're Christian or not. I hope you're enjoying today's dialogue. It's a really sparky one today between Bart Ehrman and Tim McGrew, and we're going to be concluding it in just a moment's time. Welcome back to the final part of today's programme. We're going to be hearing some of your thoughts to recent shows in a moment's time. I'm Justin Brierley. Unbelievable is the place where Christians and non-Christians get together for discussion and debate. And we're hearing at the moment the first in several programmes that I'm calling the Summer of Scripture here on Unbelievable, as we hear different scholars debating whether the Gospels are reliable. We're going to be hearing in future episodes Gary Habermas and non-believing New Testament scholar James Crossley debating things like the resurrection and answering some of the questions that you sent into the show recently. So lots of stuff to look forward to this summer on Unbelievable. Premier Christianity magazine is also something I'd love you to know about. If you're a regular listener to this programme, you'll know that I'm the editor of that magazine. And our latest August edition is already out. It's a really fantastic one with a lovely sort of artistic rendition of Holy Trinity Brompton's vicar, Nicky Gumbel, on the front, well known to many as the man behind the Alpha Course, but a special interview I did with him about HTB's church planting strategy here in the UK in the pages of the current edition of the magazine. Also interesting articles on Defying ISIS by Johnny Moore, the body image and beach culture, children's spirituality, why the charismatic church needs introverts. Faith Explored in the latest edition is two conversations I had with Michael Flournoy, a Mormon, and hearing Lynn K. Wilder's story of leaving Mormonism, and loads of other interesting stuff too. David Instone Brewer, who's a fairly regular contributor on Unbelievable, is a regular columnist in the magazine as well. And we give it away for free, or at least we do if you're in the UK. Apologies if you're stateside or anywhere else in the world. We can't offer the free sample copy to you, but you can still subscribe wherever you are in the world to the magazine if you want to get a taste of what's happening in British church and Christian culture. But you can certainly get a free sample copy if you are in the UK and you're not a subscriber. Why not ask for one at premierchristianity.com/freesample. We've also got a very active now blog going on the premierchristianity.com website. We've been covering some issues recently, including that recent video about Planned Parenthood that seems to show one of their people effectively talking about the sale of organs from aborted babies, aborted fetuses. And so we've got various comments and reactions to that, plus all kinds of other issues. In fact, we've just recently started sending out a weekly email with a roundup of some of the stories and features that we have in the magazine and on the website. So more on that, premierchristianity.com for whatever you want to look at there. Later on today, don't forget on the profile, the worldwide head of the Salvation Army, General Andre Cox, will be talking about his life and faith. And then Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor is going to be on the profile as well. So two pretty high profile guests today. And don't forget, you can catch up with today's programme as well by visiting premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. If you want to email in, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And we'll be hearing some of your response to the most recent editions of the programme after we've finished today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
We've had a really interesting programme today, the first of two in which Bart Ehrman, a New Testament scholar at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, is engaging with Tim McGrew, who's by background a scholar of philosophy and religion at Western Michigan University, but has turned his hand recently to looking into the reliability of the New Testament and Gospels. And we've heard a lot of points of difference and contention across the course of today's show on whether the Gospels are reliable accounts, how close to the events they are, who wrote them, whether the contradictions that we may apparently find between them are in fact contradictions, and should they give us any pause for concern. But Tim's essentially saying you can come up with a number of things, but by the standards of their time, these weren't sort of massive issues, and they shouldn't particularly give us cause to think, oh, we really can't trust what it was written down, because in one it's the cock crows twice, in one it's simply the cock crows, yeah, and so on.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with much of what Tim is saying, that we have to take these books as books written in their time. Unfortunately, a lot of Christians don't do that. A lot of people listening to your show think, whatever scholars say, they think that basically if John says something happened, then it happened the way that he describes it. And so if John says that Jesus cleansed the temple at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, then he cleansed the temple at the beginning of his ministry. And so they simply take what the Bible has to say as actual fact in its details. Mm-hmm. So I know Tim keeps harping on my going back to inerrancy. Inerrancy for me is the very first step that you have to deal with when dealing with kind of traditional, regular Christians who have views about the Bible. The first thing is to show that the Bible cannot be inerrant. And the way of doing that is showing precisely what Tim's saying, that it's very much a book of its time, that historians in the first century didn't write inerrant books. They disagreed with each other. They had discrepant accounts about things. And if they have discrepant accounts of things, then both versions of something can't be true if they're at odds with each other. That's absolutely right. And that's what most Christians don't understand. So that's the first step, is to realize that a strict view of inerrancy simply cannot be right. But that's only the first step. That's not my ultimate goal in life. that gets the ball rolling. That's not the end point. A bigger question is, for example, did Jesus really go into the temple and shut down the entire operation the way the Gospels say he did? That isn't dealing so much with inerrancy. That's just dealing with the historical reliability of these accounts. And my argument is that Jesus would have been arrested on the spot.
So you think something might have happened along those lines, yes, of a disturbance, but it wasn't as grand as Mark paints it.
That's what I think in this case. And Tim's idea that the crowds would have stopped the Romans, I think, is precisely wrong, as shown by the writings of Josephus. Whenever there were any uprisings in the temple with the crowds there, that's precisely when the Romans intervened. And so I think that if you simply look at what happens in Jerusalem at Passover when the crowds are there and there's a problem with what the Romans do, they intervene. And that's what they would have done in the case of Jesus, obviously.
Right. So in a sense, Bart saying, Tim, I'm not here to demolish the foundations of Christianity. I'm just saying the evidence doesn't support that every single story in the New Testament is can be taken at absolute face value, that one included. And so he'd say something maybe, yeah,
I guess
did happen.
I think Mark's getting some illicit mileage out of identifying, taking it at face value, or inerrancy, as a dictation theory. Like I said, that's been out of fashion in evangelical circles for a very long time. I dare say even at Moody, where some of the people who were students at the time Bart was there, assure me that they discussed these things without any theory of mechanical inspiration at Moody at that very time. Maybe Bart was skipping class that day. About Romans in the temple, let's talk about this. So there is a story how just after the death of Herod the Great, as Archelaus is stepping into his father's position, there is a fracas at the temple, and Archelaus sends troops into the temple and slaughters Jews there. But why? It's because those Passover pilgrims got into an argument with a group of Roman soldiers, picked up stones, stoned the Roman soldiers, and most of the soldiers died. So you had an attack, not just some kind of internecine quarrel among Jews, right? Jews versus Jews, some kind of a ruckus. There's a crowd there, and then he's gone. No, you had Jews murdering soldiers. That's what brings Roman soldiers in to put down a rebellion. Archelaus felt his newfound throne tottering beneath him. That's the reason for that kind of thing. So I think it would be more like the kind of thing we see in Acts in front of Gallio, right? But Gallio doesn't care. He says this is some kind of Jewish thing. Deal with it yourself. The Romans do not feel bound to intervene with regard to every
so
Jewish.
As far as you're concerned,
the
there's precedence for this could have happened without Romans immediately stepping in to put it down. Bart,
sure.
Quick response.
Well, just that, I mean, it's a little ironic that you want to bring up Gallio. I mean, the whole point is they arrested Paul for an internal Jewish dispute. Paul wasn't stoning Romans to death. Let me just say, I don't have a
Gallio
mechanical...
Gallio did not arrest Paul.
Okay. Well, let's allow Bart to finish.
I'm not saying Gallio. He was arrested for what he did in the temple in the book of Acts. It wasn't because
he was
stoned...
dragged before Gallio by a Jewish mob.
Exactly. I don't have a mechanical view of inspiration. I'm simply talking about what most evangelical Christians happen to think. I know this because
making a distinction here, though, between the evangelical Christians, as it were, in the pew and the evangelical Christians in the academy, maybe?
I'm talking about the people listening to your program. I teach these people all the time. My students, if they find out that there's a slight discrepancy in the Gospels, they go ballistic. And so it's not because of something that I learned at Moody Bible Institute. I'm simply talking about what Christians happen to think.
Well, maybe in that sense, what Tim is simply saying here is, well, on that level, yeah, Christians need to get themselves educated on the fact
exactly
that these
right.
ideas aren't as simple as all that.
Exactly, but, right. But that's the first step. That's
right.
The first step.
Okay.
And after that, you take other steps.
Okay. I mean, what's your view on this, Tim? If we're not kind of, as it were, you've said from the outset, you're not here to defend inerrancy. You're here simply to defend the historical reliability, you know, in common with other documents of the time of the words and life and sayings of Jesus. So in that sense, though, have you already, you know, taken a step down this route that eventually led to Bart, you know, rejecting Christian faith altogether? I'm not saying this was, it's a more complex story than that. But that's Bart's claim, is that you take this step, it leads to a lot of other steps.
Yeah, I don't see that at all. I see this as taking a stand on the kind of thing that we see in testimony all the time. This is not a matter of sort of fine-grained, things about the specific verbal exactitude. I take the discussions that we have in contemporary historical sources of the Gettysburg Address. Did Lincoln write his address on the train ride to Gettysburg, or did he not? Well, it depends on which source you read. Did he speak before or after the oration of Edward Everett? Well, it depends on which source you read. Did he read it? Did he speak from some notes? Did he speak extemporaneously? We have sources on the site who say all three of those things. Did it contain the words "under God" or did it not? Well, we've got things in Lincoln's own handwriting both ways. Still and all, the basic picture does not change. Lincoln gave an address. We even know in very good measure what he said, so much so that we don't scruple to have school kids memorize it. This is the way normal history is done.
Sure.
We need to get over the idea that it's tape recorder or nothing.
Yeah.
Let me just make a very quick response, Tim, because I completely agree with you. That's exactly right. So what you have to do in the case of Lincoln's address is to look at the evidence of whether he gave it or not. And once you establish that the Gospels are not completely reliable, that there are mistakes, that there are differences here and there, then you have to ask, are the basic events recorded in here reliable or not? And that's based on a different kind of criteria that you use for any historical source. I completely agree with that.
Tim,
I have a feeling we still have some disagreements but we'll leave it there.
We'll have to leave it there for the moment. We've got a chance to do this again, though, very shortly. So we're going to do that. And we didn't get to some of the things that I think maybe we can draw out when we next get together, such as the miracles. Obviously, the Gospels are jam-packed with miracles. What do we make of those when it comes to historical criticism? Should we assume that they're myth and legend and all the rest of it? Well, I think, Tim, you'll have some interesting things to say about that next week. As we open up next week with you guys, the question as well of whether there is a kind of internal evidence within the Gospels that points to their historicity and reliability. What Tim has termed the undesigned coincidences that give the Gospels the ring of truth. We're going to be debating that next week on the programme. So come back for that. And I look forward to you both, gentlemen, joining me again for that discussion. So thanks for being with me today, though, Bart.
Okay, thank you.
And thanks for being with me on the line, Tim.
It's been a pleasure.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, I look forward to receiving emails about today's programme. And of course, you can send me your comments as well via the Facebook and Twitter accounts at UnbelievableJB. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to follow the show on Facebook and to see some of the articles and opinions that I put up there. And I did actually put a couple of articles relating to this Planned Parenthood issue up there in the last week. And I had some people castigating me on the Unbelievable Facebook page, saying this doesn't seem as neutral as you present yourself in the moderated debates on the show, Justin. Well, fair point, maybe, but I've never claimed that the Facebook page is a completely neutral thing. I do share my own opinions on things, and I do have an opinion personally on abortion in that sense. So you can take it or leave it. Obviously, when it comes to liking the Facebook page, you probably won't agree with everything I put up there. Equally, I hope that it also encourages some honest discussion as well. And now, a few weeks ago, I asked whether anyone wanted to send in stories of whether Unbelievable has sent them in any particular direction over the years of listening to it, either towards faith or away from faith. I've certainly had a number of stories over the years of people for whom it's been part of their journey towards Christian faith. But Devin in Seattle, Washington, writes in with the subject line Christian to agnostic to Christian? He says, I'm emailing you in response to your request for listeners who have changed sides since listening to Unbelievable to tell their story. In short, Unbelievable was a key contributor to my moving away from the Christian faith into a more agnostic state over a year ago now. That being said, it's interesting to note that Unbelievable ended up basically being the sole source of Christian influence in my life since I stopped going to church and reading my Bible, etc. But I'm currently in a place where I think I want to believe and live the Christian life again, but I'm not sure how or if that can truly happen. Still, your show is a great resource as I try to work through the issues I have, and I'm always interested in hearing how others have gone from a position of disbelief to belief, as I don't know what that would look like for myself, short of God actually showing up, of course. Looking forward to hearing about the experiences of other listeners as well. Thanks so much for all you do, and keep up the good work, helping us seekers search for the truth in an honest way. Well, if you've got anything to say to Devin on that front, I'd be interested to know, what do you say to someone who's obviously had a Christian faith, has fallen away from it for whatever reason, but has some sense of wanting to come back to it? I mean, certainly, it's certainly not unheard of. I know many people who have had that experience of losing their faith and coming back to their faith. Perhaps some well-known examples might be A.N. Wilson, who was, has told his story, I think, of accepting a very kind of, strong form of atheism, and then in his latter years coming back to belief in Jesus. But there are, I'm sure, others who would have some suggestions for you, Devin. I guess whatever I would say you're looking to do in this process, obviously keep up the search, try and get alongside, someone, a sensible Christian who might help you think through some of the issues as well. But equally, don't expect to come back to exactly the same faith that you left. I'm sure that's probably not what happens in the majority of cases where people do believe again. But thank you for emailing in. Now, going to last week's program, and that was a discussion on whether the diversity of Christian beliefs, all the various types of Christian doctrines and their interpretations that are out there, undermines the claim of Christianity to be true. Andrew White was our agnostic guest in discussion with Nabil Qureshi, himself a convert to Christianity from Islam, debating that issue. Here's Mike from Detroit in Michigan, says, long-time listener, I've probably listened to every single episode. I love the show. I'm an atheist and have long seen the biggest problem in Christianity to be this dazzling diversity of opinion between Christians. Atheists don't need to argue against Christianity. Christians do a better job of it. Since Christianity has to ultimately always fall back to the Bible, and since the Bible is a historical text, it must be interpreted. There's no way around it. And fallible humans will never be able to agree. I thought Andrew did an excellent job in showcasing this. Nabil, while intelligent and cordial, failed to really answer Andrew's challenges and fell back on rather classic replies, which honestly sounded like excuses. I also think Nabil got it wrong when he said Christians should major on the majors. Well, under disagreement are very basic and important doctrines, such as who is saved. Anyway, great show as always. Keep up the good work, says Mike. Joseph Bagdanov says, I live in Santa Barbara, California. I'm a relatively new listener. I've found that the show is stimulating in ways that I've not found in other podcasts, and for that I commend you. Thank you, Joseph. My response to the most recent podcast is primarily ecclesial. I'll try and keep it short. I would agree with Nabil that we should major in the majors, and that it is the core affirmations of the church which are truly our concern, and want to go further and add that even in the midst of great diversity, the church can retain true unity. After all, unity doesn't mean homogeneity, nor does it require it. The church is one because the Godhead is one, not because we all believe the exact same things. Theological distinctions are important. I believe much hinges upon careful and faithful interpretation of Scripture, but we as one body lay that aside as we come before the cross and worship the Lord. We had a lot of comments as well in the comments section underneath that programme from last week on the website at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. People like Jay Webb, who says, glad to hear a return to Christian non-Christian discussions. I appreciate the cordial tone of the debate. I was surprised to hear Nabil make a defensive move comparing Christian diversity to political diversity. If I recall correctly, he said something like there's a wide range of political opinion in the US, from far-left liberalism to far-right conservatism. That doesn't prove the United States doesn't exist. I think that statement misses the point of the argument from religious diversity. Let me try to formulate it. Diversity of mutually exclusive religious beliefs demonstrates that many, if not all people, believe at least some incorrect things about God. Second, God wants people to believe correct things about him. Third, where there is confusion, God has the power to intervene to correct people's belief about him. Four, yet diversity of belief remains. And thus the comparison to political diversity is completely inappropriate. It would only be an analogous argument if we believed in an omniscient, omnipotent, cosmic political scientist who desired that all Americans share his political values. I think Nabil's slightly better defence was the one where he simply seemed to reject premise two in the formulation above. And just to remind you, that's God wants people to believe correct things about him. Suggesting that the details of our beliefs don't matter to God, except on a few key issues where they do matter. If any of our beliefs really do matter, and those are beliefs on which sincere people disagree, then I think the force of the argument holds, says Jay Webb. Here's Tom Hilton, though, who has a different take on this, says, to be honest, I thought the show was a bit of a waste of time. The fundamental argument that because of differences in opinion, there's no truth in Christianity, isn't logical. End of. But I thought Andrew's comment about his time at Bible college was fascinating. He argued that God should be able to answer the question, are non-believers all condemned to eternal torment? It's as if Andrew thinks God must be held responsible for the understanding of all humans. That seems to be the basis for his whole contention that he cannot find truth. In other words, he's making himself to be the arbiter of truth, and God simply needs to update Andrew with the facts, and he decided this while at Bible college? Ouch. Maybe skeptics would like to offer a theory about why all humans should be expected to understand all things in the same way. And maybe they would like to offer a proposal about why a God must ensure inconsequential things are agreed by all Christians. What is wrong with the idea that a Christian is only somebody who believes in the risen Lord? Full stop. God is concerned about rescuing lost people, not hoovering up intellectual garbage around genealogies and the first Planck time. When God offers that honest seekers will find truth, we should not expect that truth to be on strictly human terms. This is God we're dealing with, not Google. Anyway, thank you very much for weighing in there on the Unbelievable Facebook page, Tim. This is Abandon Window, is the name they go by on the page. Says, I don't know how representative Nabeel's stance is, but major evangelical organisations like the Gospel Coalition have said over and over again that you can't call yourself a Christian if you support same-sex relationships. John Piper famously farewelled Rob Bell for questioning the doctrine of eternal conscious torment. And back in the 19th, publicly condemned Greg Boyd as a heretic for teaching open theism. A great many Christians seem to find the small stuff rather important. You may have a point there, Abandon Window. Having said that, even those people, John Piper farewelling Rob Bell and Greg Boyd and so on, I don't believe they've gone as far as to say they are not saved or even perhaps not Christians. I think they simply put them outside a particular fold of Christianity, i.e. the evangelical church. But in any case, good to hear from you and the variety of beliefs there. Just one more here from Grace, who's a regular commenter. Says, rather than concluding that disagreements among Christians disprove Christianity, I'd posit that they merely demonstrate the weakness of human thought, reasoning, and or are a small snippet of evidence of the existence of Satan, who seeks to confuse and cause conflict. If children disagree about their father, it's most likely they've failed to understand him correctly, having had different experiences of him, and because they've limited ability to understand. Just as we human beings have differing experiences of God and have minds that are unable to fully comprehend God. The children may have been influenced by their own preferences, just as we can be. The children's disagreements don't negate the Father, and disagreements between Christians shouldn't lead people to disbelieve in God. Another sibling would not, on account of the disagreement, be justified in believing that their father is fictional and consequently ignoring him. They should try to find out about the Father themselves. Non-Christians shouldn't consider disagreements between Christians as a reason to reject God, but should investigate as much information evidence for themselves as they can. Why let someone else's misinterpretation influence your worldview? Anyway, you go on to give congratulations on the birth of our latest child as well, Grace. Thank you very much. Very kind. And thanks to others who have emailed in the last week with similar congratulations. Now, emails and online responses are not the only form of response I get. No, I actually received a letter in the post the other day. In fact, it was a lovely card with a picture of flowers on the front, sent by someone who described herself as Just Joan. And included in this card was a response to a bewildered Mr. Fry. I think this was Joan picking up on the episode and unbelievable sort of video that I put out responding to Stephen Fry's rejection of God. And this response of Joan says, Dear Mr. Fry, you question God's purpose in relation to creation. After all, why would he make the flea? Whatever is its function, except to bite the likes of you and me. But study its morphology, for therein lies its apology, a wonder of genetic adaptability. Of course, you're an evolutionist. The evidence for development is there for all to see. But Mr. Darwin would be appalled at the way his theory stalled when under scrutiny today. I'm probably not fit to survive, but yet amazingly alive, for in Christ I appreciate each day. In addition, when you consider The Big Question by Endeavour, you'll realise faith and science can exist in mutuality. But then those of us with faith seem foolish to that race, inhabiting your realms of intelligent academy. With sincere friends like Dawkins, I'm sure you spend hours talking about the reasons for your atheistic certainty. But what you fail to grasp is that at your final gasp, you'll be obliged to shift that philosophical immutability. What will you say on that future day when face to face with Jesus, who died for all humanity? I understand your confusion about the great delusion, but we misguided fools will continue still to watch and pray and ask for blessings on the band of those unenlightened in this land, including those named Stephen Fry, I say. With love from an everyday Christian. Thank you very much for your poem. If you've got a poem, a thought, an email, or even a story about how Unbelievable has affected you in any particular direction, be interested to hear from you. You can, of course, send it in to unbelievable@premier.org.uk. There's even a postal address if you want to use the way that Joan got in touch. PO Box 13000, London, SW1P4XP is actually the postal address for Premier if you want to send me something that way. But however you're writing in and however you're listening, I hope you've enjoyed today's programme, and I hope you can come back again at the same time next week.
You're unbelievable.
We'll be continuing our Summer of Scripture as Bart Ehrman and Tim McGrew join me again. Next time, they're going to be discussing whether we can support the historicity of the Gospels by looking at the unintended coincidences, the undesigned coincidences that Tim McGrew believes we can can find between different gospel stories. How will our sceptical scholar Bart Ehrman respond to that? Find out at the same time next week. And don't forget to tell your friends about Unbelievable too. Coming up next, we're going to be hearing faith stories and life journeys on The Profile.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.